Welcome to my conversation with Welsh golfer Mike Jones. Mike and I went into lots of areas that we hadn't really planned for. And in our conversation, Mike talks us through his love of the sport, his commitment to putting the time in to become a better athlete. He actually got down to 2 handicap after just 4 years. He tells us about how he got hooked on golf with just 3 or 4 good shots as a 26-year-old playing the game for the first time with his best friend. And he also talks about his accident, which Mike was involved in when the driver of a car pulled out without seeing him and knocking Mike off his motorbike. Although Mike remembers nothing from the moment of the accident until 4 days later, he vividly recounts the aftermath, his first steps to recovery, the people who have helped him and inspired him, and his determination to help others. Mike also explains the frustration and the mental anguish that he's had to overcome, the importance of social interaction and the learning opportunities that he now embraces. It's a fascinating story that Mike takes us through, and it's only 22 months since the day of that accident. And he speaks about how through his disability he's found the mental switch which has helped him to become a very positive person and how he's pushed himself to get back on the golf course. I hope that you enjoy my conversation with Mike as much as I did. I know you're from Wales and you're a proud Welshman. Whereabouts are you living at the minute?
I'm living in a little town called Cumbrian, which is about 16 miles from Cardiff and about 2 minutes in the car from the Celtic Manor, which a lot of the golfers would know from the Ryder Cup 2010.
Absolutely.
So,
have you always been in that area?
Golf.
Have you always been in that area, Mike?
Born at the valleys a bit further. But we moved down to Cumbrian when I was 2 years old. My father got a job at Girlings, and I've been here ever since.
Right, what's so, Girlings? Is that kind of a
An engineering firm. He was a multi-trade auto setter, multi-spindle auto setter, and he went there from the pits. He started in the pits and got offered a chance in a new Cumbrian was a new town then built in the early 50s, 1950s, and then in the 60s he got the chance of a job in one of the new factories and off the family went to Cumbrian.
And was he a golfer? Did he play any sport or just any sport or just play golf? Or?
My dad, as most of our parents did that age, spent nearly all his time in work and the rest of the time resting, yeah. Trying to support us all, but he played bowls. Once he retired in his early 50s. And he started to play bowls, and he started to play golf. I think he started playing golf when he was 65.
Right.
And he played for about 5 years every morning. He played for about 5 years with a small group of friends. He doesn't play now. He's 80 now, but he still watches it avidly.
And so to take you back a little bit to your school days, what how did you spend most of your time? When you weren't in school, when you were, let's say 12 years of age or something around that age, what was a typical day for Mike Jones?
Well, from 8 years old, it was football. That's all I did was if I wasn't in school, if in school on a break, I'd be playing football. If I was at home, I'd be out on the street playing football with my mates. And the funny one was just to sort of give you an example. I didn't realise until I thought back about this. When I was 8 years old, I went over to one of the local parks where one of the local young under-10s football teams were playing a match, all organised, but you never used to get parents going to watch and everything then. It was just the kids. And I remember going up to the manager, tugging on his sleeve and saying, "Excuse me, mate, can I have a game?" And he's looking at me, he said, "Oh no, you'll have to get your parents to sign you up and all that." I said, "Oh, I'll go on now." And I was dressed in my normal clothes, they're all running around their football kit. That just sticks in my mind. That was when I thought, yeah, I really want to do this. And I played it constantly up until I was 16. That's all I ever did.
Was it a little bit unusual playing football? Because, I mean, obviously Wales is very famous for its rugby. Was that a bit unusual, football, in those days?
It was where we were in Cumbrian, in the new town. we've got like a valley system in the South Wales. Like, I don't know if people know, but there's a series of valleys running up from Cardiff and Newport towards the Black Mountains. And at the tops of those valleys were mostly collieries. So they were a very strong mining community the further you went up the valley. Mm-hmm. And rugby was massive there. That was the only sport. But down in the new towns, like Cardiff, Newport and Cwmbran, football was very big. And there were rugby teams, but football was the main sport until you went to your secondary school, your comprehensive. Mm-hmm. That's when the sport that you played was rugby. There were no football teams in secondary school. They were all rugby teams. Right. So it was football up in junior school, and then secondary school was rugby, but there were also football teams outside that. So I played rugby through comprehensive, but football was my main passion. All I wanted to do was play football.
And did that transfer into what you first wanted to do for a living when you left school, or was that just kind of a pipe dream?
In a way, yeah. My father, as I said, he worked in Girlings, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do when I finished school. I had decent O-level results, and he said, why don't you try an electrical apprenticeship? I'd never thought of it, and I thought, I'll give it a go. And when I was interviewed for my apprenticeship, they spoke about their strong sport ethos, mm-hmm. and the apprentice school had a tradition of producing good football teams and good rugby teams. And I told them all about my football, that I'd represented the county when I was younger in the local area. And it was just thought, oh yeah, right, I'm going to do this because I can carry on playing football. They got a football team and they got a rugby team. And that was sort of the introduction to communal sport, I suppose. Mm-hmm. So you're at 16, you're in work, and you're all going out together training, and you're all playing matches on the weekend then. So it was, when I think back, it was literally non-stop. It'd be Monday to Friday would be football training, rugby training, alternate nights, rugby on a Saturday and football on a Sunday. Right. So it was literally non-stop.
So you obviously had a fascination for sport. You wouldn't have much time for anything else, but when did you start to think about playing golf?
I had a lot of trouble with my ankles and knees, injuries and twists and ligaments. And back then, as you know, Tony, there was none of this fancy equipment to diagnose what was wrong. If you turned your ankle over, you most probably torn a ligament, but you wouldn't know, and you'd strap it up and you'd end up playing the next day because you were young and you didn't know no different. So by the time I got to my mid-20s, my knees were no good for anything. I couldn't run around a lot, or I definitely couldn't play football. So that's when my best mate, Gary Derivan, he said to me, I'm going over to, there's a 9-hole golf course, he said, a community golf course. Let's go and have a go at that one day for a laugh. And we said, okay, I'll have a go. And we both hit the ball. I think we might have hit 2 or 3 shots in the whole round where we thought, we've hit them. And as with golf, as you know, you only need to hit one shot, and suddenly you think, oh God, I can do this. And it's got its hook in you then, and the addiction starts. And we both got hooked on golf that very first time we played. And we never looked back, really. We just played as much as we possibly could. I think I was about 26, 27 years old, something like that, is when I first started playing.
So, I mean, what would your normal weekend look like then? Obviously, golf would be quite a big part of your activities, I would guess.
The beauty of what I've always worked, because I was an electric, after my apprenticeship, I got a job as an electrical engineer. That was predominantly shift work, so I'd work 12-hour shifts, four days on, 4 days off. But the beauty of those shift patterns is, if Beth, my wife, she worked full-time for the council, so in the day, I could go and play golf.
Right.
And it worked out really, really well. So she wasn't too keen on me playing on the weekend because that was her time off.
Yeah.
So I had to pick and choose when I played on the weekend, but I could play as much as I liked through the week. So that it really worked well. It allowed me to commit the time to learning the game.
And you became a pretty good player, didn't you?
I joined my first golf club, that was 1993. It was Woodlake Park Golf Club, that's the year it opened. And I joined there. And within 2 years, I was down to, I think I was down to five. And then within 4 years, I was down to two. I never got lower than two. I got to one for 1 week, but that don't really count. So I was off two for a good few years, two, three. And then I slowly drifted up towards five. I think it was 5.4, 5.5 when I lost my leg.
Right.
That was 2 years ago. So.
And can you tell me about the accident? Can you tell me what happened?
Yeah. I was. I've always loved motorbikes. I had my first motorbike when I was 19 as an apprentice, a little 125. And then for my 40th birthday, Beth bought me the instruction series you can buy. You pay a couple hundred pounds, I think it was at the time, and they do the instruction course and you test at the end of it, because I said, I fancied having another bike. So we did it all properly, and it was invaluable, the training they give you, tell you the importance of all the gear and everything, to make sure you're wearing the right equipment and all the dangers to look out for, and it was really, really good. And I got a passion back for my bikes then. That was when I was 40. So I started riding bikes again, and I used them for work as I worked in Bristol, so it was cheaper for me to go back and forth on the bridge. And one night I left for work on the bike, tooted the horn to Beth, off I went. That's the last thing I can remember until 4 days after the accident. But what I found out since from the witnesses and everything, I was going down the main road by us, just dobbling along, never rush on the way to work. And a young boy didn't see me, just pulled out and hit me from the side in his car. And that was enough to crush and badly damage my lower leg and pushed my thigh bone through the back of my pelvis and broke my pelvis and the top of my thigh bone. So it was quite a nasty injury. And I nearly died at the scene of the accident, lost a lot of blood. There was an open fracture of my lower leg. But because I had all the protective equipment on, it saved me from a really nasty infection. All the paramedics told me, thank God you had the right gear on. Because with an open wound and a deep wound like that, infection is almost inevitable, they said at times. So because I had the right gear on, it kept everything in place. I lost a lot of blood, but, you know, it saved my life, I'm convinced of that.
And so you say you don't remember anything until 4 days later, so... Can you tell me what that was like when you started to come around and understand what...
This is like a tricky thing to explain, because Beth has told me and the medical people have told me that I was conscious. I didn't lose consciousness, they don't think, during the accident, maybe for a very short time at the actual moment it happened. But she said I was, like, screaming in pain when they tried to move me, and I was conversant with people in the high dependency unit. I was talking. She said not coherently, but talking. So that tells me I was awake. But I can't remember it. So it was when I sort of became aware again those 4 days later, it wasn't as though, like, I woke up. It was as though my memory and brain started to work again, sort of. Kick in. So because I was conscious most of the time, it's as though I knew I'd lost my leg, but I just couldn't remember it. So it didn't come as a massive shock to me. It's really, really difficult to explain. It's as though, well, I can't remember what happened, but I know I lost my leg. So it was, I never had that moment of waking up and, oh, my leg's gone. It was really, really difficult to explain. It was like waking up and that's how I am now. And I think that's a massive bonus for me, or help for me in my recovery, that I never had to deal with that shock. It's very, very tricky to explain.
And would it be a case of perhaps you already knew that at the point of the accident, and then, as you say, that your memory then effectively started to work again? And that you were aware of that?
Yeah, I think that's exactly, that's how I feel. it happened, as though I knew this had happened, but I can't remember all the traumatic side of it.
Yeah.
But I knew that event had happened. So that really helped me. So all the traumatic stuff, with me screaming in pain and the shock of the damage to my leg, is gone, is blanked out of my memory.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew it had happened, so it didn't shock me when my memory started to work again and I noticed it. So I think it was a godsend in a way. It's really, really helped me with my recovery because it's made me realise the way forward is, this is how I am, this is who I am, and let's go. There was, when I first met you in Spain and I spoke to Manuel de los Santos, he gave me a bit of advice. I asked him for, just give me any piece of advice you can. And he said, look me straight in the eye, and he said, never let your disability define you. And that really stuck with me, and that sort of resonates with what I was feeling in hospital. It was all like, that's it now, that's how I am.
Right.
I'm not Mike without a leg, I'm just Mike, and that's how I am.
Right.
So it was really, and that they sort of linked together those two thoughts. Just the early time in hospital and Manuel saying that to me have been like an underriding factor in my recovery and, you know, the mental pressures of dealing with losing your leg, you know.
I mean, it sounds very matter of fact in the way that you're putting it now, but, you know, can you talk me through those first months or those first weeks or whatever?
It was so traumatic in trying to your mind is just whizzing at 100 miles an hour. What can I do with this? Why is this feeling like this? Is this right that I'm feeling my leg that's not there anymore, like phantom sensations?
Mm-hmm.
And I struggled with them so badly the first month, 2 months. They caused me real mental anguish. I was in like a really bad way. They tried all different drugs with it, and there was nothing helping me. I wasn't sleeping, and I was really, I come very close in hospital to a breakdown. They had me in a room on my own, and I remember one evening literally banging my fists on the, sorry, dog.
No, it's okay.
It's good for me to talk about it.
Yeah.
Banging my fists on the tray, holding the buzzer, and the nurse came in, like, what's going on, Mike? And I don't like asking anybody for anything, so I was trying to hang on as much as I could, and I just lost it, and I said, look, you either got to get me out of this room, or you've got to give me something to put me to sleep, and I was screaming at the top of my voice, and that's the one end, one of my first, most clearest memories. Now, I think that was 6 days after the accident.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just because I couldn't sleep. I'd look at the clock and it would say 7:30. I'd shut my eyes and feel like I'd dropped off for 10 minutes, open my eyes, and the clock was still 7:30.
Right.
And that was just driving me crazy. That's how I felt. I felt like I was going mad. And they got me out onto the ward that night. And as soon as I mixed with 6 other guys on the ward, that was the start of my recovery.
Yeah.
The couple of days I spent in that room on my own with a nightmare thing.
Yeah.
And then things started to improve once I got outside, because I could look at other guys struggling and feed off them, and we could speak to each other and, you know, and help each other and all.
That social support then really helped.
Oh, definitely. That's massive. I don't know whether all amputees would agree with me, but my personal experience is the physical side of the amputation is dreadful, and it's a lot to deal with, but nowhere near as much as the mental anguish that it gives you. And I can seriously see now how it can affect your mental health. And I'm really, that's the bit that drives me. That's the bit I'm passionate that I want to help people with, because this is where the golf ties in. Getting physically active, social interaction are so beneficial for your mental health. And I don't think enough people talk about that with golf, how beneficial it is. In those terms, you get your exercise, but But people forget how important that social interaction is with others in similar situations. That really can make you a stronger person and make you realise you're not on your own and you've got a support network out there of people that want to help you. So that's, I'm slowly starting to realise over the last year, that's my real focus now. It's not the physical side, because we all get support for that. It's the mental side that people sometimes don't want to talk about.
So what were the first adjustments that you made when you sort of got over the out of the hospital?
I had an operation, a through knee amputation, and which means my thigh bone is complete, so I can weight bear on the end of my thigh bone, which is good for me. But I had issues with my wound healing, so I didn't get to walk until I think it was March. I had the all clear, because where my hip was repaired with all metal pins and a thing called a dynamic hip screw, that took 6 months to get the all clear before I could wait there. I think, I'm sure it was 6 months, I might be wrong, it might be a little bit less than that, but I think it was about March 2016, I think I had the okay to wait there. So they started, I went to the Rookwood Hospital in Cardiff, which is the ALAC Centre, Artificial Limb and Appliance Centre, and they started the process of getting me a prosthetic leg. That was when I stood on a solid frame, and they done casts around my residual limb to make my prosthetic. And I'm trying to think what date it was. I think it was the end of March, something like that. I could be wrong, but I think it was about end of March I had my first prosthetic.
Sorry, Mike, can I just stop you for a second? That's March 2016, yeah?
Yeah, I had the accident in October the 31st, 2015.
Right.
And I'm sure it was around March I started to walk again.
And then there was obviously once you got started walking,
when I stood up, I was in, I don't know whether you've ever been to a limb centre, there's two parallel bars mm-hmm. that they use to assist you while you're walking,
yep.
like a physio room. Mm-hmm. So I'm in those bars and Beth is talking, my wife is talking to the physio, and they turn around and they're looking at me and they're going, what are you doing? And I'm stood sideways in the thing, swinging my arms. And I haven't even learned to walk yet. And the first thing I'm thinking of is, can I swing a golf club? Right. What does it feel like, you know? Yeah. So they're going, what are you doing? You've got to have hold of the bars. And I said, well, I've got to see if I can swing a golf club. And we were all laughing about it. And I remember taking my first steps with my mechanical knee, which was very strange sensation. But I remember, the other one is that I remember Joe saying to me, make sure you hold on now. And I was taking one hand off tentatively to see what it felt like. And she turned around and she was going, what are you doing? And I had both my hands off. And she said to me, she said, nobody walks without holding on the first day with the knee I had, the type of knee I had. And if someone says that to me, you can't do it, you can't do that, then there's something in me that goes, right, I'm going to show you I can do it.
And
I said, right, so I walked without holding on, only about three steps, and then nearly fell over, so they were all running and panicking, but that was like, they're two little stories that stick in my mind from my first day at physio.
And I assume that Joe was your physio, yeah?
Yeah, Joe was my, she took care of me at the Artificial Limb Centre.
And what was her attitude when you said, I want to see if I can swing a golf club? Was she shocked, I would have thought?
I think in shock. In shock, worried that I was going to fall over, because she got the care for me. But when I think back, I think most people are so in shock about losing their limb and what they're going to be like. But I've seen so many people in their training since, and they all look like rabbits in the headlights, you know, they're still in a state of shock and they can't take in what's happened to them. And that's when I look back, I think maybe I am slightly different to other people. because Beth keeps saying, oh, you're one of a kind, you are, and loads of people say it, but I don't feel like I'm someone with super abilities or anything. I think it's just, I found that mental attitude, positive attitude switch inside me, and you have to have a go. That's, if I'm trying to think of the best way to describe it. Don't wait and dither, wondering, can I do it? Should I do it? Just go and do it.
And you say you've always had that mentality, Mike. Is that
I think so. When I look back, I really think that's... Before I lost my leg with golf, I think I got a reasonable standard very quickly because I always had that attitude. I was prepared to put the time in, and I would practice and practice and practice, and whenever I could play, I could play. And I'd always look to improve. I was never satisfied. Even when I got the two, I'm still thinking, right, what can I do better to get to scratch? Yeah. What can I do better to get lower? You know, and it was always, when I look back, the thing that stopped me, I'm convinced now, was my mental approach, where now it's so positive, where before I was slightly, I suppose, I guess, slightly cynical, always thinking that I couldn't do something, maybe. Where now I think I can do it. It's sort of had like a complete flip in my mental attitude. Right. And I wish I'd had this attitude before I lost my leg. It's taken losing my leg to make me realise how important a positive attitude is.
And so can you remember your first experience of actually going and hitting some balls or playing or just
hitting? But I was still having a lot of pain in my hip. And it was I was never comfortable. I always felt there was something wrong with my hip. And I went to the driving range with Michael Overton from the Welsh Disabled Golf Association. He got in touch through a mutual friend. And he met me at Green Meadow Golf Club, their driving range. And that was the first time I swung a golf club. And I was only hitting wedges, but like just chipping wedges. Only about 40 yards, 50 yards. And he watched me, and he said, this is your first time. I said, yeah, and he couldn't believe that I could hit the ball every time with a wedge, but I was only chipping him. Mm-hmm. And he said, you could play in tournaments just doing that. And I was really shocked. I said, oh, I can hardly hit it, like, compared to what it was. And I'd sort of hit six balls. Then I'd have to get my crutches because it was just exhausting. Standing up and putting weight on my legs and moving my weight back and forth. That was a real eye-opener to how difficult and how strenuous just standing up was. You know, I spent a lot of my time in a wheelchair and I practiced a bit of walking, but it was really painful. So he said to me, come along to an event in Peterstone. We've got a Welsh Disabled Golf event, come and have a game. And I played with two guys, Richie Willis and Bill Savage, and they were absolutely amazing with me. That was another turning point in my recovery that made me, they helped me. I was on crutches and I got really, really struggling to get in and out of the golf buggy on crutches, and they're both leg amputees, and they come along and have my crutches off me and pick stuff up off the floor for me. And I think I was off 24 then, and I had 10 points. And I was really pleased with 10 points. Some of the holes I thought, oh. But that's when I realised I can't hit it. I couldn't hit it any distance at all. I could maybe hit it 110 yards with my driver, possibly. And when I finished, I think I slept virtually for 2 days. I was so exhausted, so tired, and like my hip was so sore. That but the attitude that Richie and Bill Savage showed me, they were just so supportive and made me want to go again. Whereas if my first impression had been two guys who just let me get on with it, I might have thought, this is too hard, I can't do this, and I might not have bothered playing. Right. So they had that big an impression on me.
I mean, I guess you've got two communities of golf now, because you've probably got the community, and tell me if I'm wrong, but you've still probably got a little bit of the community that you had as an able-bodied golfer, and you've got this new community now of golfers with disability.
Exactly. That is so true. They've been so supportive. The guys I played with for 20 years have been amazing how they've supported me. And then the disabled guys, even that's just like another level again. It's that all the ones that I've come across who play golf, to a man virtually, are so positive. And I think you know, Tony, anybody knows, if you're around positive people, it rubs off on you. Right. And so if you're always positive and they're always positive, you feed off each other and you end up in a good place.
So what does it look like, your normal kind of golf? Because you'll play, I guess, well, I don't know, I'm going to ask the question, I suppose. Who do you play most of your golf with? Is it your old buddies that you played with previously, or is it this new community, or is it a bit of a mix?
It's definitely a mix. Just to give you like a little bit of background, where I was having all that pain in my hip, what happened? My hip had broken again, and we didn't know. So we found that out, and I had a full hip replacement in November 2016. So I couldn't really start playing again properly until January 2017 this year. So that was when I could start practicing properly, start playing properly, and I could go out with my mates, because I had a single-seater golf buggy. And that's when my golf started to kick in then and started to get the gear. I was playing not in pain. I still had to get stronger physically, but I could go out with my mates and we could have a laugh and they could take the mick out of me. And that's what you need. You need that banter is important. It's social interaction again.
Yeah. And the golf club's been very supportive, that you remember that?
Oh, they've been fantastic. They've supported me no end. They've done a couple of collections for me to help me then with travelling and tournament entries, because it does cost a lot of money to enter the tournaments, and you have to be careful what you can accept because of your amateur status. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of little... the R&A have been brilliant. I sent them an email asking them the questions, what support can I accept? And they gave me a list back. This is what you can do, and this is how you can take support from people and organisations. And they were absolutely superb, the R&A, and done nothing but congratulate. In the email, they said, pass on our congratulations to everyone in all the disabled golf associations because you're doing amazing work. It was a really, really nice email they sent me. So
that's good to hear.
That helped. So the golf club support me, the Golf Union of Wales support me, and I got a couple of family members who helped me out as well.
And going back to the playing, so from a playing perspective, what kind of challenges do you now face that perhaps you didn't previously have to deal with?
I was one of those people, and I've come across a few who think that it's been really easy for me. And if I'm honest, I thought it was going to be easy for me when I started. I thought, well, I played this before to a good standard. This shouldn't be an issue. But if anything, it was more of a hindrance, because it took me a while to come to terms with, I can't swing the golf club like I did before. I've got to work out a new way of doing it. Right. So Rob Moss started coaching me when I first started playing well, the beginning of this year. And we worked out some new techniques I could use, some different stances and different alignments. And then it's literally playing as much as I could and work on different scenarios, like how I'd stand, how I'd align my feet, how I'd turn my shoulders, my grip. And the one thing I'd stuck with is, I call it a 3-round rule. So I'll make a change, I'll try it, and if it's great, I'll try it the second round. And if it's great, the third round. And if I still hit it well with it, that's it. That technique is in. Right. And if it isn't there, if I lose it the second day or lose it the third day, then I don't use it. So over the last 10 months, that's slowly being refined. So now I've got a nice set of routine with things I think of and things I do that I know work. And there's lots of other things that I've tried that haven't worked. They might have worked for one round, and then, right, it hasn't worked. That's not consistent enough. Put it to bed. So it's a huge learning process. The playing before has helped because I understand technically what I'm trying to do and things I can't do. But I play in a completely different way to how I did before.
I think probably strategically all you've done before has probably helped you because you understand how to get it around the golf course. But of course, how you do that technically is obviously different. And are there any specific shots that, as a result of your disability, that you find more difficult than previous?
Oh, yeah. If the ball is above my feet on a side slope, that is so difficult. I have to just chip those shots. Now I've learned not to try and... It's the strategy again. Don't try and take on more than you can do. So if the ball's above my feet, I know I can't put a full swing on it because it affects how my prosthetic leg works when the weight is on the toe. So I just chip those and get them back into play. Right. But that also comes into effect is I'm always looking, right, where are these side slopes? Right, make sure you don't hit it down that side.
Yeah.
Because you don't leave it on that side. You can't do that all the time, but that's always in my thought process. And the other one is a downslope. If it's a slight downslope, it's not too bad, but as soon as it gets to a reasonable downhill slope, they're very, very difficult for me because I'm left leg amputee and right-handed. I might be able to sit my weight on my left side, but my leg is locked straight, which means I can't get down to the ball.
Right.
So, and you see in all the golf lessons on the television, always stand with the slope.
Right.
So you try and tilt your body to the slope you're standing on. Well, I can't do that. So a down slope is really, really difficult for me. So that's another scenario where I've learned I just have to just chip the ball into an area where I can hit a full shot.
So let me just clarify that. So when you say a downslope, you're talking about when your left foot is below the level of your right foot.
Yes. That's the most difficult one.
Right.
Because of the type of leg I've got where I have to lock it straight to support myself when I'm hitting my golf swing. So that's really difficult. But then that comes into the strategy thing again. It's learning that, right, I can't hit that shot very well, so don't try and hit it. Hit it like this and get it back into a good position. And I think a lot of disabled golfers still try to play the full shots or normal shots all the time when they're in situations where they don't like to admit defeat, so to speak, and say, look, I can't hit that shot, I've got to do it this way.
Yeah.
And if they did, I think that breeds consistency then.
Well, again, the nice thing about what you're talking about here is that you're learning. And all the time, by the sound of it. You're learning new ways of doing things, and that's quite exciting. That's good for the mind anyway.
It's I can't explain to someone how fantastic it is, because all the decent golfers I've spoken to, I say, can you remember when you first got it? When you first went from a 16 handicapper to a 6 handicapper, can you remember? And they're going, oh, it happened so quick. And they forget that buzz is amazing. So now I'm getting to do that again with a bit of experience.
Yeah.
So I understand how to refine the process, where before, when you do it the very first time, it's raw because you've never done it before. And I'm like in such a privileged position to be able to learn the game again. It's really exciting. So suddenly when you find something that works, you really appreciate it because it's been taken away from you when you've had your accident or became disabled. To when you start to hit shots close to how you did before, it's such a thrill. I honestly thought I'd never be able to hit a shot like I did before. And I'm starting to get close to it, and it's just such a thrill.
Yeah, so, I mean, what have you learned about yourself maybe as a person, but maybe as a golfer, you choose which scenario you like to talk about.
I think they go hand in hand. A golfer and a person. I'm sure that everyone who's played golf has heard this saying: if you want to know what someone's like, truly like, play around the golf with them. Mm-hmm. Because they can't hide it. Nobody can hide it on a golf course. If you're an angry person who shouts and stamps your clubs, then there's no doubt you're an angry person at some point off the course. Or if you're a mellow person and things don't faze you, you tend to be a mellow person off the course. So the one thing that I learned about myself is how strong I actually am. Where I never realised it before, and now I'm starting to realise I am quite strong now mentally. Yeah. I'm starting to realise by the things I'm doing, and I'm looking, and I'm when I'm working hard at physio, I'm thinking it's not being disrespectful. They're saying people are not working as hard as me, because they are. We all work hard, but I think I've just got that switch inside me that's been flicked on. When I've lost my leg, that switch is turned on, and I'm now fully motivated. I know I'm capable of doing things, and I won't underestimate myself or underestimate my ability. I think, yeah, I can do it. If I get it right, I know I can do it. And this, that self-belief is so important.
Well, I guess, I mean, look, you obviously are going to be a role model for many people with disability who acquire a disability, because they'll be able to have a look at what you do and how you do it. But did you have heroes or role models that you looked to as you kind of progressed through your career? Well, the first part of your career as a golfer with disability.
Yeah, well, there was, as I mentioned earlier, Manuel de Los Santos. All I kept doing in hospital, I'm laying. Sorry, that's got me.
That's okay, take your time.
Once I was on the ward with the guys, you get a lot of time sat. I was in hospital for only five weeks. But all I did, when I didn't have visitors, I was on my iPad and I'm watching videos. Uh-huh. But I was obsessed with playing. I was obsessed with playing again. It saved my life. I really don't know what I would have done if I didn't have golf as a focus and a drive. I don't know what I would have done. I really, God knows what sort of, I would have ended up in not a very nice place, I don't think. So it's literally saved my life, and I watched videos of particularly Manuel and hearing him speak and talk with such enthusiasm and positivity. It's like you don't often get a chance to reset your life, but that was my opportunity there. I thought, that's the attitude I want. I want the can-do, gonna-do-it attitude. Yeah. So saying it and doing it, a different, you know, you can say it quite easily, but doing it is another thing. And whenever I'm feeling like a bit low or a bit sorry for myself, or woe is me, I've lost my leg and I can't do this, I'd watch the video. And it just, right, get on with it, Mike. Stop moaning about it. And then to actually meet him in Spain, this is the beauty of Edgar, to meet someone like that and speak to him person to person, and then to speak to me like a real friend, give me advice and shake my hand, and Juan Postigo, when I met him, yourself, Sue, you just get it. You just feel that positiveness coming out of people towards you. And that's what I want to deliver to the people I play golf with. You know, he was a big role model of mine. You know, the way he approached his disability and the way he talked about it. He told me, don't let your disability define you, and that's what I think. Right? I'm not Mike with a lost leg, I'm Mike. And that's really important, really, really important.
Of all the things that you've learned, Mike, is there, I suppose specifically from playing golf, are there two or three takeaways that you might think would be helpful to others?
The first thing is, to any disabled person or any person who's had a stroke or had cerebral palsy or MS or struggling with any kind of condition, golf can turn your life around. You don't have to be a superstar hitting it loads and loads of distances. All you need to do is be able to hit a golf ball and put a golf ball. You can go to a golf club and you can speak to people and meet people, because it's all about not being isolated. When you become disabled, it's quite easy to turn in on yourself. Yeah. And not communicate with others. So golf, disabled golf especially, is a great forum for people to start communicating with each other and realise you're not on your own. There are people out there that want to help you. There are people out there that can turn your life around. Mm-hmm. And the work they do, the people behind the scenes, I've been playing golf nigh on 25 years, something like that. But I never knew disabled golf existed. And I'm ashamed to say that, because now I do know that it's there. All I can think about doing is, what can I do to support these people? What can I do to get them playing? What can I... Look at the benefits you can do. And it's just... You can see how these people are so enthusiastic, and you get that switch and you want to help people. You turn it on and off you go. You know, come and do it with us and play and make yourself healthy again.
With your experience, is there any adjustments that you would make to make golf more friendly for golfers with disability?
Yeah, I think maybe do a particular one for people who suffer with fatigue, and maybe make a where you could do a special tournament and do it 3 9-hole rounds. Mm-hmm. Instead of 3 18-hole rounds, so people don't suffer from the fatigue, because fatigue does come into it a lot. Yeah. With the different illnesses and disabilities, we could look at that. It's difficult to say. There's, the way things are done at the moment, there's lots of different variants to it. But the beauty of that is, we get the people playing, and then listen to feedback from them. Like, what would you think would improve? Because I don't think people ask them sometimes. Mm-hmm. So let's ask people. And then we can, it's a developing game. Disabled golf is fairly new, I think, you know, maybe 10, 20 years old, maybe longer than that, I don't know, but it's fairly new. Mm-hmm. That there's been organisations around. So it's communicate to people, and let's see, can we refine it and make it better for everyone, or better for certain people? There's things that people struggle with, what can we do to improve that? That's the one I would, the biggest one at the moment would be maybe making a 9-hole tournament. Yeah. For people who suffer with their conditions, make them suffer with fatigue.
Yeah. And there's a lot of good work being done by lots of different people all over Europe, or all over the world, to be honest. And
yeah.
You know, so there's some really good initiatives, and I think you're right, is that, you know, we have to listen to the players, because the players understand it better than any of the administrators will ever understand it. So I think you've touched on a very good point there. I mean, is there anything that we've not touched on up till now that you'd like to discuss? Because I've got a couple of general questions I want to ask you just before we finish off, but I want to give you the opportunity, if there's anything particular that you'd like to discuss, then now's a good time.
The biggest one, my message to everyone is, come along to play disabled golf. If you know someone that's disabled, or someone who's had a stroke, or someone with a condition that they feel is debilitating, get in touch with them. There's lots of local organisations. Your local golf club will put you in touch with organisations that can help you. Because if they go out there and play, that's the key factor, is Just go out and participate. It doesn't have to be a competition. It's just meet those people that want to help you. And there are people out there. You mustn't feel alone. You've got to, there is support out there. So that, like, that's the one driving thing. And the other, well, I'm trying to think what the other is support. It's all I want to do is just people to feel they're supported. There's someone behind them on their side that wants them to do well and wants them to get better and wants them to feel better as a person. That, you know, that I'm just constantly telling people all the time, you can do it, you can do it, you can do it.
Just a couple of general questions before we finish. Is there anything about Mike Jones that might surprise us?
Oh, God.
Or should I be asking Beth?
I'm a big crybaby. I get so emotional now where I very, very rarely did before. So I love singing. I'm not very good at it, but I love singing. I'm always singing to Beth in the car.
Is that your Welsh background there coming out?
Bit of country and western.
Oh, right, okay.
Tell me. I'm a secret singer.
Just got two more questions for you. So this one here is a big one, which is, if you could magically be with someone who's just experienced a similar kind of accident as you did, at the moment that they opened their eyes to what is effectively a new world, what advice would you want to offer them at that moment?
So, I've met two new amputees within 2 weeks of having their legs, because I've gone back to Rookwood a couple of times and to Morriston, and both of them have said, you're not alone. Mm-hmm. Don't think for 1 minute you're on your own. And the limb loss isn't the end of what you had before. It's the start of a new life. And grasp it with both hands. Because it's really important when you speak, I think, when you speak to someone who's just lost their leg, you tell them that it's not the end of everything, it's the start of something new. And I think if you can get them in that mindset from the very first moment they open their eyes, I think you'll see nothing but positive recovery from them.
Great advice, Mike. If people would like to reach you, how could they find you?
If they want to see anything about me, I've got a Facebook page, which is at Mike Jones Golf. Just search that in Facebook, and there's a lovely, ugly picture of my mug. So you'll see me there. I'm sat on the Slocum Bridge. So, have you got my email address? You've got my email address, Tony, I think.
Yeah, what I can do, I'll put it on the end of this. I'll put it on the end of the article.
Forms of contact, or through the Welsh Golf Union, they can contact me, the Golf Union of Wales, or through the Welsh Disabled Golf Association.
Excellent. Well, Mike, I really appreciate your time. It's been fascinating to chat with you, and I know that you've had a good year so far as a player, and I know that you've got some more events to come along, so I'm sure that it'll be a good end to the season for you as well. But really appreciate your time, Mike, and thanks for sharing all your knowledge and your wisdom.
Tony, it was an absolute pleasure talking to you, and thanks for all the work that you and Sue do behind the scenes. I know people don't get to thank you very often, but I'm going to be one of them.
Yeah, appreciate that. Thanks, Mike.
Okay, mate, and I'll see you in November.
See you then. Take care. Thanks a lot, Mike.
Thank you, Tony. Okay. Bye now.
Bye.